Excuse me, everyone. This is the operator, and I just need to inform you that today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect your line at this time, and you may begin.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the IRTPD Working Group call on Monday, 30th September 2013 at 15 UTC. On the call today, we have Volker Grayman, James Bladel, Mike O'Connor, Barbara Knight, Graham Bonton, and Angie Graves. We have from staff Lars Hoffman, that Christine Durain has joined. From staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Marika Connings, and myself, Julia Charvelin. And we have apologies from Bob Mountain, Paul Diaz, and Holly Raich. May I please remind all participants to please say their names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thanks, Julia, and thanks, Lori, for riding herd on the bridge. This is Mikey today because James is in Arizona, and so I'm going to run the call. And we'll do the usual deal where we take the pause and look at the agenda and the statements of interest. I think today we're going to mostly zero in on charter question B. We have a drafting team that's working on the charter question about some of the TERP stuff. But we had a big debate before the call as to whether that's a dog's breakfast or a dumpster fire. So we're going to pause on that for a week and see if we can get that rewritten. So with that, any thoughts about the agenda or statements of interest? All right. Oh, I note that Aubrey just joined, too. Welcome, Aubrey. I think with that, we'll just jump right in. The next item, I sort of gave you a preview on that, is that there is a drafting team that's working on, I've forgotten which charter question. Let's see. It's a charter question. Yeah, so it's the one where registrants can get access to it.
I think it's C.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, D. D is in dog. Thanks, Gene. We're making really good progress there, but what we discovered when we really dug into the TDRP is that that policy was written back in 1999, and it's tremendously disorganized. It's got all kinds of things in the wrong place in the structure. It's a very hard policy to rewrite because of the fact that it's so badly organized. And so the drafting team has sort of taken upon itself the project of rewriting the TDRP, not changing the words in it so much as changing the way it's organized that makes it easier to rewrite. And given that, we've had a couple of very successful meetings, but we're still working. And so rather than take you through something that's really not ready, we decided that we would switch back to some of the other charter questions where our initial report draft is in quite a bit better shape and start working on those instead. The other thing is that it will help. Some of these will feed into the work that we're doing, and so that's sort of the state of affairs. Does anybody have any concerns, questions about that before we move on to the main topic of the day, which is charter question B? James, go ahead.
Thanks, Mikey. James speaking for the transcript and for the group. I missed the last session. There was a last minute to reschedule, and I unfortunately had a conflict, but just a couple of questions regarding the reorganization of the TDRP, and perhaps it's something that was discussed already extensively on Friday, and if so, I apologize, but just want to make sure that we're mindful of things like the TDRP that have, even when we fix them and make them better, they can still have a pretty significant operational impact for service providers like Christine's organization, like Barbara's organization, like mine, and just want to make sure that we're, wherever possible, taking a light touch. And I know, Mike, you said it's, at this point, it's mainly just reorganizing the existing language as opposed to you know, changing it. And I think that's probably a you know, a sound approach. But I just wanted to get that out there that I think we've I know in my situation, even when I've tried to fix things internally, that sometimes these things can have a domino effect fairly quickly that I didn't anticipate. I will do my best to attend future drafting sessions as well.
Thanks, James. I think at this stage it's safe to say that we're mostly just moving words around in the document. You know, we have things like remedies, for example, where there are remedies sprinkled all up and down that document in different paragraphs. And basically what's going on is we're taking things like that and pulling them all into one place, which I think from an operation, certainly the goal from an operational standpoint is to make things easier rather than harder. But absolutely for sure, we want to bring this whole thing back to the working group. It's just that it's not done, and rather than subject you to reviewing something that's really not in very good shape yet, you know, it's better, but it's not done. We thought we'd wait a week and take another round at it. And clearly, if we goof and introduce a bump in the road, there's no issue at all at sort of rolling back. But I think it's gonna, you know, what I see so far, I'm pretty enthusiastic about. I think it's a lot easier to understand the policy, and I think it will be a lot easier then to introduce some changes. One of the, you know, clearly the change that caused all this is the access for registrants to the policy. And we've got what we think is a pretty flexible approach to that, where we could either put that in the existing policy or essentially create a separate policy. And once this is rewritten, it's going to be a lot easier to do either of those things. So I think it's just a worthwhile investment in tidiness more than anything else. But for sure, there's lots of room to review. Okay,
awesome.
I don't
thanks.
See anybody else in. Thanks, James. I don't see anybody else in the queue, so we'll just give that a second, see if anybody else has any thoughts about that before we go forward. I don't want to get into any discussion of changes that we're proposing yet because, as I say, it's really not ready. But okay. Let's go on and spend most of the call today then on charter question B. What's on the screen in front of you is essentially initial report draft language. So I think hats off to Marika and Lars for getting that pulled together. And I think this is sort of a first walkthrough of the real deal. With that, I think probably the thing to do is just sort of take it chunk by chunk. So the first part, I think, is pretty stable. But there are a couple of interesting comments in here, where basically it's talking about the issue of multiple transfers. This is a conversation we've had pretty much through every single IRTP working group. And this is where the group that set up this multi-phase project sort of put the hard questions for the end, and this is clearly a hard question. So one of the things that you can see in the comments is the stuff from compliance, and maybe I'll throw this to either Lars or Marika just to sort of give us their interpretation of those two comments. Either of you want to take that on?
Yeah, this is Lars. I'll give it a shot. Sorry, I'm just going through them to remind myself. Just if you give me 1 second.
these servers?
Yeah, so I mean, what they're noting is basically, I mean, the issue that we have been struggling with too, right? So that the middle, the transfers that are following the initial hijack are obviously legal and can comply with the TDIP and the IRTP as they, or with the IRTP, I'm sorry, as they stand. The complaint that compliance receives most of the time is about hijackers gaining control of the admin contact, the email address, and then requests a transfer. And so from a compliance point of view, once it's been hijacked and they have access to this data, then there's very little that compliance can do from their perspective unless it's been proven that it's been hijacked in the first place. And obviously the problem also being, and I suppose it goes back to the registrar as well, that they need to be able to supply some information, or the original registrar, or the registrant claimant maybe even, as we call it maybe in the TRDP in the future, that once the hijacker has the control of the admin contact details and can change those, how do we know that there was a hijack in the first place? And that's a problem that compliance can have, and that we might have with this, and that also will feed in, obviously, to the things that we are working out currently for the TDRP question in this subgroup. And I'm going to leave it at that, I think.
Okay. Thanks, Lars. There's a little queue building up. James, go ahead.
Thanks, Mikey. This is James. And I agree with the comments here from ICANN Compliance, and would probably note that I don't know, at least without reading further down, I don't know that we are proposing any particular sanctions for registrars who are involved in subsequent transfers, or even registrars that are involved in the initial transfer if the transfer was the result of a hijacking because someone had gained control of an email address. I think compliance is correct to point out that these problems are usually predicated on a compromised email account as opposed to anything, any sort of misconduct on the part of the registrar or negligence on the part of the registrar. But my concern specifically is with regard to subsequent transfers that, in the case where a registrant, and this is touching on the last paragraph here, in the case where a registrant believes that they have legitimately purchased a registration and then later find out that it's subject of a dispute from two or three hops ago, that registrant may believe it has a civil case against its against the registrar that we've determined here was, sort of a co-victim in this whole hijacking thing. So I don't know what we can do from a policy perspective to acknowledge that, in those cases where we would reverse a transfer that had several subsequent hops, we may be creating liability down the chain for those registrars who accepted those contracts or those transfers in good faith.
Thanks, James. I'll get to Chris in a second, but I think the first part of your comment may contain the seeds of the answer to the second, and that is maybe in this policy we need to acknowledge that lack of negligence on the part of the registrars in the transfers. Take the comments that the compliance folks have written and turn that into a piece of the policy as a way to sort of head off that cascading liability thing. Some better legal minds than mine are going to have to help with that, but that might be a way to mitigate some of the risk that you're concerned about there, James. So we might want to file that away for the subsequent round of drafting and not just discard these comments, but actually think about some way to work them into the policy. Chris, go ahead.
Thanks, Mikey. Just so I'm clear about this, because I might have missed what you were saying last for a second. Are we looking at situations here that go through compliance where control has been taken of the email address and the account? A likely hijack has taken place, and then compliance have ruled that everything was in order on the basis of the email addresses, and to which compliance are then saying, that's it, everything's in order, end of complaint, issue resolved. Because they don't want to, rightly or wrongly, step out of a narrow vision of this into a territory of what might be hijacking, what might be partners splitting up in a business, what might be a simple mistake, etc., etc. Is that what we're saying is happening, Lars?
Lars, over to you.
Thanks, Chris. I think the difference here is what compliance point out is the difference between inter-registrar and inter-registrant transfers. And so what they're saying is, for them, what has taken place, without knowing or being certain that a hijack has taken place, which is then a different issue, the actual transfer is correct because the policy has been followed. So in the past, the registrant has changed. You know, that can happen, obviously, legitimately. And that new registrant is then changing the domain to a different registrar. And since we're looking at the latter of this, the change between registrars, there's nothing that I can compliance based on the policy that stands right now can do about, because the issue would be the original hijack rather than the transfer between registrars, if that makes sense.
Chris, you want to come back?
Yeah, it makes sense. I don't like the sound of that. I don't know if that gets escalated anywhere or reported anywhere. That's just what I'm just sort of trying to...
The ICANN on compliance gets reports by people complaining about the hijack in the first place, which is something I believe that falls under the inter-registrar would be something of... that has to do essentially with the change between registrants, which is something that the IOTPC has dealt with. And so that's something that doesn't fall under the close charter question, if you want, as it's worded for this working group. So they receive complaints. They receive complaints about hijacks. But ICANN compliance can't under what the question that this question that we're dealing with right here, right now, is not to do with hijacks between inter-registrant transfers, where the hijack comes into. It's about the transfer then onto a new registrar, which is slightly different.
James just dropped off the call. Chris, back to you. You want to come back again?
And if I can just add, Marika to also just point out, obviously IRTP Part C is in the process of still being implemented. So that might add to the gray area here that we're in right now. So the transfer between registrants is something that has been dealt with or addressed by the previous working group and has not yet been fully implemented.
Right. I mean, that's where I was going to head on this one, too, is that this looks like sort of an historical interpretation, but I'm not sure it's correct going forward with the new the way the policy is written right now. That does raise an interesting puzzler, because the IRTPC implementation working group is silent. At least nothing, as far as I know, has happened on that. Can we tease this apart into two pieces? One is the impact of inter-registrant transfers is embedded in IRTPC. And then the second part is the point that James raised earlier, which is the one about sometimes these are not compliance issues. And then James in the chat raises that question in a little bit more refined way by saying, are we asking for a compliance action or are we establishing TDRP eligibility? I think we need to clarify that, and that's one of the things that we're doing in the TDRP rewrite is we're adding a section there called standing, which sort of describes the circumstances under which various parties, either registrars or registrants, can initiate a TDRP. And that may be a way to address some of this, at least on the TDRP side. I'm not sure what that implies for this. So I hope somebody's taking notes, because I'm not. But we need to capture those points and get them folded into this, because they're valid. James, are you back on the call? I hope. I don't want to go too far without James, my co-chair.
Yes, I'm back on. Sorry about that.
Oh, good. Okay. I just, I didn't want to get too far ahead of you.
Good question, Chris.
And James, I think those are both good ones. Let's make sure that we capture them and think about how we fold them both into the draft. I think that these certainly belong in the issue description, but also, into our suggested change to the policy. Okay, let's go on to the next part, the working group observations part. And maybe this is where some of those comments show up. We had that big discussion about how far back should it go, and we agree that it should go back to where it got stolen. We talked about... James, go ahead.
This is James speaking. I'm kind of torn on this one, Mikey. As you're aware, we certainly don't want to put hard-coded time frames on these things. We're just teaching hijackers how long they have to cook a domain name before they can move it. If you say 60 days, they'll wait till day 61. If you wait for 6 months, they'll wait for 6 months and a day or whatever. But I do... see the other side of this coin anecdotally, with some of our internal experiences. I remember a few years back, there was a case where a domain name was hijacked and the registrant didn't notice for over a year. I can imagine where if someone had invoked a dispute on a transfer that had occurred, 14, 16 months ago, that would also be disruptive. Not only to the registrars involved, but also the registrants that were involved and subsequent registrants. So I'm just pointing out that we should be careful here, and I think make sure that we have a thoughtful response to those types of concerns, as opposed to just saying, we go back to where the problem started and start disputing from there. I think a recognition that that could be several years past. I think should be part of our observations at a minimum.
Yeah, I think that's right. I know that the conversation always sort of revolved around sort of normal law, which is if you buy stolen property, it's still stolen property, even if... So, you know, maybe we need to build more words around that, and I'd be open to hearing suggested language there. You know, maybe what we're saying is we need another paragraph to explain that and give people sort of a heads up, but I would hate to march in and say, oh, by the way, if you've managed to successfully steal a domain name for X month, it's yours. I think that's a problem. Good, I got some bites. I've got registrars in the queue. Go for it, Volker.
Hi, Mikey. One question about U.S. law I'm not certain about. Under German law, once a stolen item has been auctioned off by a public auction, then it no longer is subject to any clawbacks by the previous owner. So when a domain name is just transferred between owners, when it was stolen, it can be probably be reclaimed. I don't have an argument with that. But once it's in an auction, I think the case is different, at least under German law. I'm not sure how it works on U.S. law.
That's interesting. So there's a puzzler for our further research, is to make sure that you know, I hadn't ever heard of that before. So if I can take anything and auction it off in public, that washes clean all of the prior history, huh?
Basically, because that is because when it's a public auction, then the owner of the stolen property should be aware of that and should have... be able to gain knowledge that the goods have been stolen and be able to stop that auction from happening. So basically, by auctioning of something up in a public auction, you assume that the owner of the stolen property is able to gain knowledge of the fact that it has been stolen and be able to take action at that point. Once it's auctioned off, then... The new owner has a certain element of trust in the fact that he has purchased something in an auction and therefore gains ownership.
Now, I would presume in that circumstance, this is Mikey again, that the auction house has duties and responsibilities to do due diligence prior to putting it up for auction. Is that right?
I would assume so, yes, but only to a certain extent.
Because, that would be another thing to research, because it seems to me that could actually be more disruptive than what we're proposing here in a way for, you know, CETO, for example, if they had to go and essentially carry the burden of researching the prior history of the domain before they could put it up on auction. That would certainly change the speedy auction stuff. Interesting. James, sorry, I put you kind of on hold there. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. I'm still kind of processing Volker's comment here and what the implications of that might be. So I just wanted to point out, it sounds like what we are saying, in effect, is that if you are the victim of a domain name hijacking, your rights of recovery essentially have no expiry or no statute of limitations. And I'm not judging whether that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that. I'm just trying to say that seems to be where we're going with this. And I think that's possibly... raising the question of, you know, does the industry require some sort of a, we always use these tortured analogies from the real world in the domain name space, but are we looking for something like a title search or Carfax equivalent for domain names? And I wonder if that's where this is headed, because if you're going to have some sort of rights of recovery in perpetuity, then I think that is going to really shake up some of the aftermarket activities. And it will cause someone to wonder, if you didn't originally register a domain name on your own, you'll never be 100% certain that it is legitimate.
Yeah, well, I think that's sort of along the same lines as the question I was asking Volker, which is, what's the duties and responsibilities of the auction house? If the auction washes it clean, that would actually be useful in a way. But what that also seems to mean to me is that they would have some duties and responsibilities. Otherwise, if I'm a hijacker, I immediately put it in the auction, and I leave the who is and DNS information alone, so that the registrant maybe isn't aware of it, and poof, it's auctioned off, and now I'm out of domain and have no recourse because it's been washed clean by an auction house. That's not a happy thing, I don't think. Volker, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that this is something that we should follow. I mean, that's peculiar to German law and only in certain cases where this applies. I'm not even sure that the current providers of domain name auctions would even qualify for such a public auction. However, this is something that I just wanted to raise as one possibility where the chain of illegitimate transfers could be cut. Basically, I agree with you that this is a puzzler that it's very hard to determine where to make a cut or when to make a cut between sales, because I see a great potential of hurting innocent buyers at a certain point who have no way of finding out that a certain item has been stolen.
Yeah, this is always the trade-off when you're dealing with stolen merchandise. It's, somebody's going to get hurt. That's why it's a crime, And the question is, what do you do about it? Aubrey's got an interesting, I'm sure slightly ironic, sarcastic comment, but actually I think legitimate auction becomes domain name laundering.
That's
a problem. I'm cranky about that.
On the other hand, if we now say that transfers become become subject to retroactive backtracking, or any domain transactions become subject to retroactive backtracking for years to come, then aren't we hurting the second level market in a way that we cannot even estimate at this time? Because every domain sale might be contested 10 years in the future if we do not set a limitation to that.
Well, I think that's where the access to the TDRP, the standing issue with TDRP, and the hoops that have to be jumped through that we write into that become important. I don't think that the intent is to allow frivolous use of that, or just like there's... well, what is it? Reverse UDRP. Not the right phrase. But I don't think that a person who maliciously files a TDRP should be able to do that without some sort of penalty. In a way, it's a lot like the UDRP, and there has to be an orderly way that people establish that they have the right to bring that action, and if they can't establish that, then they shouldn't be permitted to do it. Yeah, reverse domain name hijacking. Thanks, Christine. Volker, are you back in the queue? Go ahead if you want.
Yes, I'm back in the queue. Just one point that I just one scenario that I just cooked up, which would be probably a horror scenario, which but we should take care of that as well. I mean, two parties acting in collusion could decide on making domain transactions coming from a certain portfolio undoable. For example, I want to sell as a domain owner. I want to sell a certain number of domain names in a fraudulent way. So I sell them to party B without creating a contact. Party B disappears after a while. Party B sells the domain name to the real buyer with a contract. So parties A and B would be acting in collusion, but there would be no way to prove that. Party B, as they have disappeared, is no longer in the picture. Party A comes out 2 years later stating that the domain names A, B, and C have been stolen from him by B. B is no longer to be found. All domain names have to be given back to A. Good profit for A. Question, how do we prevent that? And as there's no record of that, I don't think it can be prevented. It would just be abuse of this policy.
I'm not sure. Again, I think this is where, you know, party A would have to establish standing and would have to demonstrate, I think, sort of along the way, some documentation steps. Sort of waving my hands at this because this is part of what that part of, you know, that's what giving registrants access to some sort of policy like this does, is it provides them a mechanism to do it. But it seems to me that we have to write it in such a way that they can't abuse it. James, go ahead.
Sorry, mute button was a little slow. James speaking for the transcript. So I'm going back now in the chat to something that was posted by, I believe, Christine earlier on, and I think that while our intentions are good as far as not setting any arbitrary cutoff time frame for this, I think that we may be forced to as the lesser of two evils, just because we want to maintain compatibility with the TDRP, which currently has, I think as Christine pointed out, a six-month time frame on it. So it seems like regardless of what we do, if we want to continue to use or to dovetail into that, then and if we are indeed saying that we're not asking for compliance to get involved here, that this is more of a function of how to manage disputes, then I think that we need to go back to what the TDRP sets as a requirement. Say, essentially, if this thing is happening longer than 6 months, it's probably too far gone. Just an opinion at this point, but I think it is something that we need to consider unless it is our intention to completely throw the doors open on TDRP as well, and then in that case, I think that's actually a bigger issue.
Yeah, I can see how these conversations are pretty interlinked. And I think Volker's point in the chat is well framed, which is I just think that we need to make sure this policy cannot be abused. I think that's where we're all headed. You know, a policy that is at least very difficult to abuse, probably impossible to write policy that can't be abused, but as close as we can get to that. But then B, also policy that doesn't disrupt the operations of, say, the aftermarket. That's why we get paid the big bucks. We got to figure this out. So I think this is a good conversation. Having said all that, let's go down to the actual recommendation for a second, sort of see how we're doing. I'm on page 2 now at the bottom, where we say transfers from a gaming registrar to a third registrar. All other subsequent transfers are null and void if the gaming registrar acquired sponsorship from the registrar of record through an invalid transfer as determined through the dispute resolution process set forth in the transfer dispute resolution policy. Anybody want to bounce our current conversation off of that recommendation? Essentially, I think what this would do, let's play with some scenarios. One scenario would be that we leave, let's leave 6 months in the TDRP for a minute. We did that, and this would all be fairly recent history. Presumably, these transfers, as many, it would basically be as many hops as you could get done in 6 months. Because after that, the TDRP wouldn't work. You wouldn't be able to use it. At which point, one of the things in the TDRP and one of the things that we pulled up into a more obvious place in the TDRP is that if the TDRP doesn't work for you, you always still have the option of going to court. It's not like the TDRP is the absolute end of the line, and maybe that's the way out of this dilemma. Is, you know, if something happened quite a while ago, 14, 16 months ago, like James's example, the person who, you know, the losing registrant or registrar still has the option of going to court. And maybe that's the backstop. That makes things easier to accommodate here. Barbara's in on that. James, go ahead.
Hi, Mikey. James speaking. One other thought you mentioned, I think it was the statement you mentioned that was, you know, we don't want to include any kind of a cutoff that would tell a hijacker, you know, hold on to a domain name for 6 months and a day and it's yours. I think that we can certainly say that while a name is not necessarily eligible for any kind of a clawback after a certain time frame, 6 months or whatever, we can certainly say that the registrant who currently has it as a result of a fraudulent transfer doesn't necessarily get to keep it. You know, we could say that the registrar should be required to delete it or repossess it and allow it to expire, you know, or something like that. I mean, I think it can still be, you know, punitive to the party that actually took the name and not necessarily make it an attractive option to just cook those names for 6 months. And I think that we could do something like that without introducing this whole you know, concern about perpetual clawback. So just thinking out loud that we could bake some other stuff into that as well as just, you know, not just having a hard cutoff.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that has happened for me, having really dug into the TDRP for the very first time over the last couple of weeks, is that I think... I think that some of this can, in fact, be handled fairly gracefully in the structure of the TDRP as it stands. One of the things that you're talking about there, James, is the remedy portion of the TDRP, which is another problem with the current document, which is the remedies are sprinkled all over the place.
Right. In that case, you know, that seems like the one primary remedy that we've all been working from is return the name back to the person who it was taken from, or the registrant prior to the illegitimate transfer. And I think what I'm trying to put on the table is that there are other possible remedies short of returning that name that could also be considered.
Yeah, although then, you know, I'd have to cogitate about that. You know, I am always casting myself in the role of the losing registrant, and I'm sort of going, good grief, why would I ever engage in a TDRP if the best that can happen is that the name gets deleted? I want the name back. I think at that point I'd go to court. Anyway, Christine, go ahead.
Oh, Mikey, yeah, this is Christine from NIF. You just made my point. That was it. I was just going to say I don't think anyone's going to pay to participate in the process if they're, you know, not going to get the domain name back.
Yeah, I can't imagine who would initiate that, James. And Barbara's in on that. Okay, well, this has been a pretty tidy discussion. I think that one of the problems with this particular recommendation as it stands right now is that it's not nuanced enough. And I think where the nuance comes in is in the actual structure and flow of the TDRP itself. And I think what this gets me to is that we, the drafting team, really need to get that revised draft to you all in time for the call next week. Because I think that some of the issues that we are tackling here are handled in remedies, some of them are handled in standing. Some of them are handled by the availability of a court proceeding, and that this recommendation kind of crosses all those lines, and we need to step back and kind of understand that better. James is good. James, we aren't evil enough to put ourselves in the mindset of a hijacker? Oh, I suppose I could. Anyway, any other thoughts on this? I'm sort of feeling like this section needs a better understanding of where we're at with the TDRP before we finish it. And I'm reluctant to go much further today. I'm happy to carry on, but you know, we're sort of getting into endless recursive logic here. You know, we're kind of covering the same points over and over, and then I'm saying, well, yeah, but that's in there, and I think we really need to get a new version of the TDRP in front of the group. And maybe what we'll do just get it to you faster in a slightly rougher form than I was hoping for. But it seems to me that without having something in front of us to look at, we're getting a little bit stuck. Lars, go ahead.
Thank you, Mikey. It's Lars. I agree that the details of this will probably depend on the TDRP outcome. I'm just wondering, and I know that time is running out, so that might not be today, but something that I think the group might want to think about is what is key, I think, for this question is whether or not there should be a principle that if a domain has been hijacked from a registrant, that registrant can go and use the policy to claim the domain back, and whether or not there should be a statute and limitation on that or not. What that may be or may not be is a different question, but as a principle, does the group believe that that should be the case or that there should be a statute, whatever that may or may not be? I think that would be something useful to answer this question as a starting point. As I said, maybe not today, but something to think about.
You know, and this is Mikey, that's a good correction, Lars, and you're right. And as we've had this conversation today, it does seem to me that this is sort of layered defense for the registrant. First layer is work it out with the registrars. Hopefully that happens, usually does. The next layer is the TDRP. And the last layer is going to court. And because going to court is always available, maybe that's the backstop for the very unusual circumstance where a name is stolen and too much time has passed. One of the things that I think rewriting the TDRP does is makes that clearer. And James raises the point that it's not free for them to do that, but, you know, that's always been the case in a way, because up till now, the registrant really only has two options. They have a free option and a go-to-court option. So I'm not sure that really changes things for the registrants in that regard, James. I think maybe the rewriting of the TDRP itself may actually make the rights of the registrants clearer, and that in and of itself will make it an improvement from the registrant's point of view. Aubrey's raising, is you can always go to court a good terminal position for us to count on in policy? I'm not adverse to that. Otherwise, it makes us the court of last appeal, Aubrey. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily a good thing. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I'm in a personal situation with a sand mine where I had to go to court. I tried everything else, and it didn't work, and had to do a lawsuit. I don't know. Sometimes these things just work out that way. But I don't have strong opinions. Any other thoughts? We're getting fairly close to the top of the hour. We could end here, but if people have other thoughts, my main takeaway from today is that we've really got to get cracking on getting that TDRP draft to. Aubrey's point in the chat is, should our policies be complete? And yes, there is court, but for us to assume that it's the exit point is a movable line. Aubrey, why don't you jump on the audio and give us that one in words. That I didn't quite track that one. If it's easy for you to do audio. James, I'm inserting her in the queue in front of you. I hope that's okay. But Aubrey, you want to just expand on that a little bit?
Hi. Sorry. Yeah, I didn't have my microphone activated, so I had to go through that. I wasn't planning to talk at all. basically, what happens is if we assume that the terminal action of our policies is, you can go to court, then we start to have a question of where do we put that? Whereas if we have a set of policies that come to a resolution, that have an appeals mechanism, that don't leave dangling questions open, court is where you go when you don't like the decision you got out of the ICANN complete process, not an issue of the process always terminates in court. I know it may only be a nuanced difference, but also, when it becomes one of the pieces we play in how do I build policy, it really doesn't matter what I do because I can always go to court in the end. And so it becomes it's a mechanism I worry about putting in, and I think that it makes sense as this discussion was evolving for us to look at the possible problems and say, how is that resolved within our system? Our system should be complete. Court is beyond our system, I guess, is what I was trying to say. Thanks.
Thanks, Aubrey. I think that's useful and helpful. I will point out that court is in both the TDRP and the UDRP right now. Both of those policies have language that say if this doesn't work for you, this doesn't preclude going to court, I think. Christine is typing. I always defer to Christine because she's my mentor on this stuff. And I think that then what we are engaged in is an exercise of trying to sort of try to have our policy handle most cases, 90X% of the cases, but an avenue for those outliers and then defining what those outliers are. And this is an interesting conversation. Christine's got a giant comment in the chat. Sorry to, Jane, well, let me just read Christine's comment because it's still in this thread, and I'm sorry to park you, James. Christine's saying, I'm thinking this way, very low value domain. If the registrar can't fix it, the wrong, maybe the losing registrant says, that's no good. Too bad. Medium value. Maybe they pay to try a TDRP or something. High value. Maybe you skip the TDRP and go right to court. Not every avenue is right for every domain name. And I use the word value loosely. It's all relative. That's another good thing. James, with that, I'll take it to you, and then you can wrap up.
Yeah, thanks, Mikey. And I think there's some merit to what Christine is driving at, particularly when you consider that in the context of looking at timeframes, that no one is going to let a very high value or a high traffic domain name be hijacked for more than a couple of days or even 16 months or whatever. Usually, those things are noticed within hours. So the time frame becomes less of a consideration. But I just wanted to maybe change gears as part of the wrap up here and note that we are, by my estimations, now entering October, which gives us, five weeks prior to when we need to start thinking about putting a button on our initial report for the Buenos Aires meeting. So does the group believe that perhaps now is a good time to revisit our work plan and our deliverables? I know we're pretty much off the page there because we were targeting September for a initial report, and I think we are early September. So I think we clearly are off the glide path there, but I think that maybe just revisiting that work plan, updating it, and making sure that we're all still on board with our time frame might be something we can add to next week's agenda.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. We got an agreement from Lars on that. And I'm still thinking that we might be on a glide path to at least have a preliminary version of the initial report in enough shape that we could have a pretty productive public session in Argentina. I don't know that we'll have a consensus draft. It's pretty tight for that.
Right.
But, I wouldn't be surprised if we had something that was close enough that we could frame a pretty interesting series of questions and take that to a public session at Argentina and get some feedback. So, yeah, good idea. All right, it's 1 minute after the hour. Thanks, folks. That's it for me. We'll see you in a week. And drafting team, I guess that being me and Christina and Lars, I guess we got our work cut out for us. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye. Thank you.